Bad alcoholic. Man, I cannot, you guys, I can't believe the welcome, just the attitude of people down here. It's not like California. California, you know, they spend a lot of time with words, a lot of words, and you're, you get done with them for 15, 20 minutes, and you still don't know what you got. Down here, I can't understand anything you say, but I know what you got. I'm talking to Bobby B last night, and he's going, I go, what? He goes, that's the way it is. Am I right? That's the way it is. Yeah, I know. You guys, I know you just don't understand. But anyway, the love and the warmth and, you know, between, you know, Belinda and Ashley and all the welcome committee, everybody that's just, you know, put this thing on, it's a big deal. All you guys do in the service, it's a big deal. So thank you. And I mean, and I always think about the people in the back that were serving us dinner, right? Sam and the crew. You know, and then we had this breakout session on concert. It always brings me to tears because you know what? You can't fake service. You either do it or you don't, right? And the people that are doing the service, they never are looking for it. They just do it. And they do it out of love. And they do it out of love of this fellowship because this program called Alcoholics Anonymous saved all of our lives. Some of us know it really well. Some of us are just getting to know it, and so welcome. And you don't necessarily have to raise a hand, but if you've got, let's say, less than 30 days. Anybody less than 30 days? Yeah, I saw it. Good. You're fine. That's great. And for you to be at a Fellowship of the Spirit conference within 30 days of your sobriety, you hit the home run, girl. You hit the home run. Because you got people around here that know what this deal is about. So, all right. So I think I got about, not quite an hour, but a little bit of time. All right? And what I want to do tonight, you know, and I always pray about this stuff because it matters, you know. It matters a lot. You know, God struck me sober, and I'll talk about that, but God struck me sober July the 9th, 2002. So I'm coming up on, God willing, 22 years. And when I came in here, there's a thing that, you know, it's Rowan Hazard had it, and it's called the gift of desperation. You know, the gift of desperation. I can't remember, page 28, 29, somewhere in there. And the idea behind it is like a drowning man. And what I want you guys to do for just a minute, I want everybody in here just to hold your breath. And don't breathe, and don't laugh, don't sneeze. Okay, let go. All right, let's do it one more time. And this time we're going to hold it for 30 seconds. Fifteen to go. Anybody getting uncomfortable? A little bit more uncomfortable? Okay, break off. I used to do it longer, but people pass out and you get in trouble. People get passed out. Pat, what'd you do? We got somebody in here who could help out. PT, you could help out, right? But here's the thought. When I am drowning, how important is it to find air? I'm going to do anything in the world to find air. And what I hope to communicate tonight is that when we all came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, however we got here, whether we knew it consciously or unconsciously, we had a gift of desperation. And when I came in, you know, I'm 65. I was 42, and my sobriety day is July the 9th. My birthday belly button's the 17th of July, so that's why 42. And I had been drinking. I started drinking when I'm 14 years old. By the time I came in here, I had a gift of desperation like there was no tomorrow. And I'll talk a little bit about it. I want to spend a zillion hours on the before I got here. I want to spend almost all the time I can on what happened and what it's like now and how these principles, how these steps save our lives, okay? How we are introduced to God of our understanding that is absolutely amazing. In fact, I wouldn't know God today if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have no relationship with God today if it was not for Alcoholics Anonymous. So the things that happen to us when we're growing up, you know, and we all know some really hard stories. A lot of us have had the hard stories, but that's not what makes us alcoholics. And we're going to talk about what the definition of an alcoholic is just for a moment. But before I go there, so my family, I learned early on, Pat, what goes on in the family you don't tell to the outside world. We got secrets. And the secrets don't belong anywhere out there in the public. You know, mom was a drug addict alcoholic, and she had major depressive disorder, so she never cooked a meal. And I had to write a resentment on her, and you know, and she's dead and gone now. But at the time, you know, I love my mom. But at the time, I didn't understand what the heck was going on all the time growing up. And a lot of bad things happened because mom wasn't on the job. And a lot of things happened with my dad because dad wasn't on the job, because dad didn't want to be around the family. Dad wanted to be at work because it was too stressful to be around mom. And so I'm about 3-4 years old, and mom says, I don't want to raise you. Let's have grandma raise you. So and that was fine by me because I was in love with my gram. She was great. But by the time I'm 14 years old, all the stuff that was going on in the family, I was so unbelievably uncomfortable. And I figured, you know, even at 14, I'm thinking suicide's a good option. Anybody ever feel that early on? Amazing, isn't it? I mean, you see all the hands popping up? And I'm thinking suicide's a pretty good option. And one of my buddies said, hey, try one of these Mickey's Big Mouth. Anybody know those Mickey's Big Mouth? Dude, when I had that first Mickey's Big Mouth, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was a relief I'm looking for, and we all know that experience. And so it took me to a place out of myself, in a place where I could just sort of relax in my own skin, and it worked really well. I had some other things. Everclear. Anybody ever drink Everclear? I got Barrett's esophagus because of Everclear. Okay. Worth it. Worth it. But the reason I bring that up is that for a long time, alcohol absolutely saved my life. Remember that time when I was doing it for you? By the time I'm 17, I have my first 12-step call on me. My coach calls me in. He said, and I didn't know I was being 12-step. But he said, Pat, no one can pronounce another person an alcoholic, but I think that you ought to go to some meetings and find out, because if you don't, I think you're probably going to die. So what was going on in my life in terms of just craziness and, you know, drinking, I mean, I was drinking with the allergy of the body from day one. I didn't know it. I didn't know what it was called, but I could never control how many drinks I was having. I didn't know if I started on a Friday night, if I drink till Friday midnight or Monday afternoon and miss school. But that was sort of the way it was early on in my drinking, and it never really changed. So coach says, go to Alcoholics Anonymous or you're probably going to die. There's some stuff happening in my life. And I'm going, thanks for the advice, but no thanks. And so on goes, I go towards the end of my senior year in high school, and nothing's solving anything anymore. And even the drinking's not really working. I mean, drinking quit working at a major level by the time I'm 17 years old, and that's bad. And I didn't get sober till I'm 42. So I got 25 more years of this torture stuff ahead of me. So senior year, April, you know, the wheels are coming off, and somebody says, if you give your life to God, I think you could stop drinking. I think your life will turn around. And so I give my life to God. I quit drinking. And I don't drink for the longest period that I had since 14 years old. I didn't drink April, May, June, July. 4 months. In our life, that's a long time. So then I go to my freshman year in college, and the first night I'm uncomfortable in my skin. I mean, that's sort of a normal condition. If I'm awake, I'm uncomfortable. You know, if I'm awake, and I'm facing you, I'm uncomfortable. I don't even know what restless, irritable, and discontent means yet. I have no idea about a spiritual malady. I have no idea about AA. But all I knew is that you put me in a place where I had to live in my own skin, and it wasn't a comfortable place. So I go up to college, and the first night we have a dorm party. It's going to be a kegger. I'm uncomfortable. I hadn't drank in 4 months. I got God in my life now, and I go, you know what? It's going to be okay. I'll have a drink. I'll have a beer. I'll bet you'll be fine. You know, no big deal. 4 months. I got this. Got it. Don't remember a whole lot about the rest of my freshman year in college. And I kid you not. I remember a lot of Everclear. I remember waking up with people I didn't know in places I shouldn't have been. That was pretty common. And the school loved me enough to say, don't think we want you to come back next year. So he said, goodbye. So off I go, and you know, I won't share all this stuff, but I go through for the next 2 or 3 or 4 years just doing odd jobs, working at ski areas, being a snowmaker, doing whatever I need to do just to get by, getting enough money because I figured this working but not going to school or not getting a degree might be a problem. So I'm thinking maybe I'll go back to school. I go back to school, but I'm drinking. I'm not drinking. I'm not binging. I'm trying to stay sober. I'm not sober. And that's going on. I finally get my degree. And for the next, fast forward now, for the next 15 years, it's just sort of more of the same. But the last 10 years of my drinking are bad. My last 10 years of my drinking are bad. It's in 19, I get sober in 2002, not by my choice. By 1989, the wheels are really coming off. And my first marriage is blowing up because I can't seem to not sleep with women that are not my wife when I'm drinking. I knew it was a problem. People told me that's a bad thing for marriage. And I couldn't stop it. I just couldn't stop it. And so I'm going, I've got to get sober. So now, I am asking God on almost a daily basis, please God, please God, please God, get me sober, get me sober, get me sober. And I get nothing. 1989, and I don't get sober to 2002. So for 13 years, I'm asking God, as I understand God at the time, please God, get me sober. I really didn't want to lose my wife, lost my first wife. Have an affair, end up with a second wife, have affairs all over the place. In fact, the very first, it's just a cluster. You know, self-will run riot, it's a cluster. It really, truly is. And so I lose the second wife, and now I'm getting to the home stretch, and I'm going fast forward, but, you know, by this time in my work, and I was pretty good at what I did. I was in sales, but my work was taking me around the country to speak at different groups for my industry. And you remember that movie by Denzel Washington called Flight? Remember that? And then they had the guy that had to go with him to keep him sober so he could testify or do whatever he was supposed to do. I had a guy assigned to me in my company, and his only job was to keep me sober so I could show up at the thing the next day to do the presentation, and he didn't do a very good job. He didn't do a good job. And so, you know, bad things are happening. I mean, I'd fly into Texas, and I'm supposed to be at a conference for 4 days, and I wouldn't show up. I'd get there the first night, and we'd go out for a couple pops. And that was it. I was 5 days later, I'm sort of showing up like, where is everybody? I'd fly into Atlanta, and the same thing would happen. You know, this back in the day where you could, you know, get on the airplane without a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't any TSA and all the rest of the stuff. But I'd try to do airline scheduling, and I'd fly into the wrong airport. Now it's a pretty normal thing. And so that's sort of, you know, some of the lighter-hearted stuff, but the other part wasn't so lighthearted. It was pretty dark. Lived in Colorado and we had a mountain property and a mountain house because I was making money. I figured if you can make money and be drinking, you must not be a drunk. I figured that was the truth. And my kids didn't have the same kind of reaction. Breckenridge is a cold place in the wintertime. And my only job was to be able to pick up my kids at the bus stop in Breckenridge after skiing at 4 o'clock. Now, we had this little mountain, you know, you can't really call that mountain house. It was like a little shack over on the other side of Breckenridge in this other place called Alma. And we'd start drinking. I'd get them to the ski area, and then I'd be about you know, 8:30 in the morning, I just think, you know, a couple of Bloody Marys aren't really drinks. I mean, that's lighthearted stuff. That's just like amateur kind of stuff. I'm just figuring Bloody Mary is no big deal. And I couldn't show up to the bus stop till 7:30 that night. And my kids are standing outside, and albeit in ski clothes, but they're standing outside at night in 0, 5, 10 degrees below zero, and they got tears in their eyes. I say, Daddy, where were you? In the summertime, my girls were in competitive soccer, and it's hotter than heck. It's not as hot as Louisiana hot, okay? But it's hot, okay? Colorado has hot. And we'd be at the soccer field, and my girls would run out of water, and they'd say, Daddy, can we have some of your Nalgene water before we get home? We're just dying of thirst. And I knew they were dying of thirst, but I have vodka straight up in my Nalgene bottle. I always had vodka in my... Doesn't everybody have vodka in your Nalgene bottle? I mean, you don't, that's what you put in your Nalgene. And I chastised my kids saying, you should have brought your own water. You should have had your responsible for your own water. And I got stuff like that going on. I got places where I'm driving on the wrong side of the road, going too fast on black ice, you know, mountain passes. And my son, who at the time 16 years old, is crying and begging me to pull over. Daddy, you're going to kill us. And I would backhand him across the chest saying, shut up, I know what I'm doing. Don't talk to me that way. How do you make that kind of stuff right? The fear I put in my kids, and my two girls were just quiet in the back seat. They didn't say a word. They're not going to say a word. By this time, I have a restraining order against my first wife. You know, we got bad stuff going on in our lives. Second wife, you know, I'm cheating on her before we'd been together. I left my first wife for the second wife, who was a cheat, during the first wife to meet with her. And I'm cheating on her the first weekend with somebody else because I had to go to a wedding for a client thing. And I was just going to have one drink at the bar. And I don't get home for 3 days. And I'm not where I belong with somebody I didn't belong with. I didn't belong with the second one anyway. But you get where I'm going with this? It's a mess. So that's enough of that part of the stuff. But along the way, you know, I'm starting to feel, you know, the alcohol is catching up with me. I feel snakes crawling out of my skin. I'm starting to have hallucinations. My liver's got hits going on. The doctors are saying, you know, I got a permanent slur in my speech. That's, you know, one of the gifts that I've got going on here. I got Barrett's esophagus, got all this stuff. And the doctor's saying, Pat, if you don't quit doing what you're doing, you're probably going to die. This is a fatal disease that you're playing with. I said, thanks, doc, for the information. Anybody here had people, loved ones, just tell you over and over and over and over again, please stop, please stop, please stop? We were lucky enough to have somebody in our life like that. A lot of us didn't. A lot of us just, they just pushed us to the curb and you're alone. But I had some people in my life that were trying to do that. And I, you know, inside, I wanted to stop. I didn't want to be that guy. I, even as crazy and fouled up as my growing up days were, it was not designed that I'd be a serial cheater. It wasn't designed that I'd be basically verbally and physically abusive to my kids, to be an errant parent and get kicked out of business, kicked out of relationship. And my kids, by the very end of my drinking, said, Dad, we don't care where you live or die, and we never want to see you ever again. Ever. So I cheated one more time in July of 2002, and there's this incomprehensible demoralization. I don't know if it has to be, but it seems like a lot of the folks I end up working with, there has to be some kind of moral conduct, some kind of moral compass that goes on inside of us that wherever you're at, to me, there had to be something that said, I don't want to live this way any longer. Bill Wilson had it. He said, you know, I wanted to make amends to Lois. I wanted to take care of Lois, but I couldn't. It was too late now. He wanted to rectify his mistakes. And I think at some place that shame and that guilt overtook me to the place where I just didn't care about living or dying. And so I told the truth finally to a therapist I've been seeing. It was always the second wife's problem. It wasn't my problem. And I'm telling the therapist all sorts of lies for 3 years. It's her problem. You know, she doesn't understand. I got to travel for work. I got to support the first wife to support the second wife. I got this going on. I got child support. I got alimony. I got problems. I never told her the truth about my drink. I never told her the truth about what was really going on. She said to me a very eerie thing at the time. I finally got enough courage to tell her the truth, and I said to her, her name is Sally, and I call her every sobriety date. And I thank her, and I thank God for what she did in my life. She said to me, Pat, no one can pronounce another person an alcoholic. But I got a place called the Dragon's Den in Colorado that I want you to go to. I want you to go to 6 meetings, and I want to see if you hear your truth. I want to see if you identify with these people called alcoholics, and if you do, they got a solution for you. She had enough courage to tell me the truth, and she was a therapist. You know, Dr. Silkworth told Bill Wilson, said, Bill, he didn't say in these words, but I mean, if you look at his pedigree and look at his history, Dr. Silkworth was the man in all of treatment industry in that era, probably even to this day. He was the guy, and he basically said to Bill Wilson, said, I know what needs to happen for you to get better, but I can't cause it to happen. I don't have the ability as a medical doctor to do it. You have to have an entire psychic change, Bill. Every way that you're built, how you're wired, concept, thinking, feeling, everything about you has got to do a 180. And Bill, I don't know how to get you there. And I think what's going to end up happening to you is you're going to die. Or you're going to go wet brain insane. Be locked up. Roland Hazard meets with Dr. Carl Jung over in Switzerland, has eerily the same kind of conversation. And Dr. Jung, who is at the time leading psychiatrist, studied under Freud and broke off, said, Roland, I know now what's wrong with you. I was hoping you weren't a real alcoholic, basically is what he's saying. He says, hoping you're just major depressive disorder, because I could deal with that. But I think you're a real alcoholic, because after a year of intense treatment with you, everything that we've tried, I really thought you had a shot at this thing. I thought you were going to have a vital spiritual. He said, I thought I could get you sober. I thought I could keep you sober. But you went out again, and this is after everything. Hidden springs, you knew all the hidden springs, and it wasn't enough. You're going to either die, be locked up, you're going to have to hire a bodyguard if you're going to live in this world and function for the rest of your life. Because I have no hope for you. I'm the finest medical doctor there is. I have no hope for you. That's the word to an alcoholic. We have no hope in the medical community. Don't take this the wrong way, because I love Fellowship of the Spirit, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But this fellowship is not going to keep Pat sober. Knowing this big book is not going to keep Pat sober. Being able to quote it and move it and doing all the stuff that we do, even sponsoring others, is not going to keep Pat sober. Now, we're going to get into how the circle and triangle on God power works, not on Pat power. But circle and triangle on God power changes everything. So I tell Sally the truth. And I say, Sally, I don't know what's going on. She says, get over to the meeting at Dragon's Den. So I get over there. And you know what? Gift of desperation is a gift of desperation. I put everything on hold. Because I couldn't work anymore. I've been fired from the last thing. And my partners kicked me out. So I don't work for the first year of my sobriety. I go to 3 meetings a day, every single day. You know, I don't know about 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm going to 90 meetings in 30 days, right? And the very first meeting, I met a lady named Thalia. And Thalia, I'm 42. Thalia at the time must have been about 60-ish. And they're going around this room, and I have, this is my first ever meeting Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what I just walked into. None. All I know is that my therapist said, these guys have a solution for what's wrong with you, and I don't. Go see what it is. So they're going around the room. They're going, Sam alcoholic, Fred alcoholic, Sally alcoholic, you know, Karen alcoholic, and everything. They go around the whole room. They get to me, and I go, Pat, and I don't know what I am. It's like bees to honey. It's like bees to honey. And I have no idea what's happening right now, but it's going down. They look at me, and Thalia looks at me, and she says the most profound thing, and it's about the only thing I remember from the meeting, because everything else sounded like, sort of like Cajun talk, okay? For Pat. And so that's not an insult. It just means I have bad ears. And I got hearing aids to prove it. So anyway, Thalia looks at me and she says, it's a narrow room. There's only like 30, maybe 35 people in the room. And a bunch of long rectangle tables are put together. And she's at one end and I'm standing up near the coffee station in the back. And, you know, I'm feeling lower than well done. And I'm, you know, there's no hope. And I really, literally, my thought was, if this doesn't work, I could always commit suicide. There wasn't a second choice. And I'm a tough guy. You know, I don't share emotion and I don't cry and I don't do this and I don't do that. And that, you know, I'm so broken, I'm so shut down that I have no emotion in me. I just have this sliver of a flicker of wanting to live more than I want to die. You know what I'm saying about that? It was so razor thin. And somewhere in my spirit, I knew that if I didn't take this opportunity, I was going to die. And I really wanted to live. Thalia looks at me and she says, Pat, and she has these penetrating eyes, and she knew the deal. She was a Fellowship of the Spirit, Don Pritz, the whole nine, Don P, sorry. But she has all the stuff. She knows what's going on. And she looked at me and said, Pat, if you'll do what we've done, you'll never have to feel the way you feel tonight ever again. I remember to this day, it was like clear as a bell. And then the meeting went on, but I'm hearing that. And so, you know, the meeting gets over and people are trying to go where they're trying to go. And I started hanging around these three meetings a day kind of thing. And one of these other guys got sober at the same time I did. And his name was Aaron. And Aaron was about as bad as I was. I mean, they wouldn't let me hold a coffee in my hand for about the first 2 weeks. I was like this. And then they'd let me hold a coffee, a half a glass, or, you know, half a cup. And then finally, I remember, like, it was about 30 days, and I got the full cup, and I was going, hey, full cup, full cup. You see in the full cup, you know? And so that's going on, right? But along the way, and I don't have a sponsor yet because as desperate as I was, I'm dumber than a box of rocks. And I don't know. I don't know what this whole thing called sponsorship's about yet, and I don't have any clue about it. And you know, although I'm in this Dragon's Den's meeting, and you know, I know it's on tape, good bunch of loving folks, but they really didn't know the work. It wasn't really the core hardcores. It was a nice fellowship, but they didn't have a whole lot of solution going on. But Aaron in the room, he's getting better. I'm watching the guy 30 days later. He's going to his main meeting because he can't work either. So we, you know, Aaron and I are sort of joined at the hip. And he can't work, but he's giving the meeting, and he's changing. I mean, I'm watching this guy start to change. And this is where we're going to spend some time on this thing called the spiritual malady, because, see, I didn't know what I was up against. And I think a lot of people in AA, we don't realize what we're up against, and we think there's options besides giving our life over to the care of God as we understand God and doing these steps. It's not a program of suggestions. The program itself is suggested. The steps are not suggestions. You get me on that? Aaron got that, and Aaron's working with a guy that knows the deal, and he's turning statements into questions every page, and they're going through the work, and he's finding out his truth of step one, that when he drinks, he has a physical allergic reaction to the drink, and that Dr. Silkworth says, this happens to you, it doesn't happen to people that are non-alcoholics, and Aaron, you got the allergy. And when you're stone cold sober, Aaron, and you are not intending to drink, you got the strange mental blank spot, you drink against your will. And Aaron, up to page, you know, 23, we know that the program's in our mind. I mean, we know that the problem's in our mind, sinners in our minds. But that's not the whole deal, because by the time we get over into how it works, we find out that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So we got this spiritual component going on in the first step, and it's after the dash, this unmanageability of our lives, untreated alcoholism. And Aaron's starting to get a grip on that stuff. And you know what? I don't wear all the steps. I'm not really reading the book yet, and I'm going to go find my own sponsor because I find out that Aaron's got a sponsor, so I'm going to go pick my own sponsor, and I find my first sponsor, and he's 10 years sober, so I'm figuring that's good. He's also got business connections, and if I ever want to work again, I got to have a connect, right? I'm not trying to ruin my life, not at all. And so I meet my first sponsor, and I find out after a couple grumpy sessions with the guy, he said, listen, you get here at Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock, and if you're late, don't ever come back. Well, I couldn't sleep Monday nights because I was too scared that I'd oversleep. And this guy was cranky. I mean, cranky, 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 cranky. And it wasn't just because he was cranky. It was because he had already gone out, and he was drinking on the sly. My first sponsor was relapsed. We get through first step as best he could, step one, two, and three, and I do not have a solid step one experience. I don't know what's still wrong with me. And we go through, we're doing inventory, and I'm reading him inventory. He said, okay, you're going to do, and this is nothing against Joe and Charlie, checking the boxes, and you could get to some truth about that. I can find truth in any kind of inventory process. All right, so hear me clearly. If you're doing inventory, God's going to do some God stuff in your life. All right, it's going to happen. But for me, it wasn't at a level deep enough for me to understand what the heck was going on, because all I had is on this inventory sheet was a bunch of check the boxes, check the boxes, check the boxes. And Tom asked me, he said, what do you see? And I go, check the boxes? I don't know. What am I supposed to see? He said, well, that's good enough. I said, Tom, I've only read, I'm 7 hours into it. But he said, and I got like this much more, right? He says, I'm done listening. I don't want to listen anymore. You're my sponsor. You have to listen. I said, no, I don't. He said, you just go on about your business now. I go, wait a minute. I don't know much, but isn't there like a step 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12? There's like, Tom, there's seven other steps. There's seven other. Pat, you'll get it. Just go on about your bit, because he was too convicted in his own life. He couldn't handle it anymore. And shortly after that, he's out. Later on, he makes amends with me, and we have good relationship today. I mean, it's a changed deal, but pretty amazing. So my second sponsor, I know by this time, I got to go get somebody. And so one of the guys that's there every morning at my 6:45 home group is a guy named Buddy. Buddy played hockey back in the day when hockey played without masks and played without helmets, and he was a goalie. He'd seen the puck a few times. Now, what I'll tell you in all honesty and sincerity and love, and in fact, I was just talking with my best friend in Colorado still this day, who saw me the first day I walked in these rooms, was my best man in my current marriage. I'll tell you more about that. Buddy's still alive and doing well, and I'll tell you what I learned about Buddy. I learned 12-step calls with Buddy. I went with Buddy 5 nights a week, and we went to some of the craziest places you ever seen. We jumped iron gates, iron fences. We had K-roll syrup and orange juice, and we had sugar bars, and we had shooters. And we went, and we were rescuing drunks. And we'd take them down to detox. We'd take them to the treatment. We had it all going on. And I don't regret any of that time. 12-step work is incredible. But Buddy, we had read the work, but I really wasn't his sponsee. And now I'm like 4 months into sobriety, and it's getting to, I think the suicide option is looking pretty real. I like going with Buddy at night. It's fun to get in trouble and do what we do, and it's sort of exciting for 5 minutes, but it's not enough. Kids still aren't talking to me. I don't have a job. I don't know what's going on. I'm over the shakes, but I don't have any prospects. I've lost everything. I'm living basically out of the car. It's bad. It's bad. It's all outside, so I don't even know what the real problem is. It's inside. And suicide is looking pretty real. And I'm looking at Aaron one more time, and I said, Aaron, who's your sponsor? Real compassionate way I'm asking. I mean, I'm really coming to him for I need some help. I'm at another get to desperation place, and I got my heart out on the table in like a good alcoholic man. Aaron was there, and he said, no way am I telling you who my sponsor is. I am not telling you who my sponsor is. dude, you got to tell me who your sponsor is. You're getting well. I'm not. What the heck are you doing? I listen to you in the meetings, and you're talking about the physical allergy, the mental obsession, the spiritual maladies, present-day agnosticism, untreated alcoholism. You're talking about powerlessness in step two, and you're talking about the insanity and that has to be restored from insanity to sanity, and that there is a spiritual basis of life or else. And Aaron, I don't even know what you're talking about. It's going crazy, and by this time he's on his inventory, and he's talking about resentment inventory, he's talking about fear inventory, he's talking about relationship inventory, he's talking about this new sexual ideal, and I go, I need one of those. I have no idea what he's talking about. It sounded pretty good, you know. Sex was in the word, and hadn't had any of that for a long time, and all this stuff's going on, and I looked at him, and he wouldn't tell me the sponsor, but I got time on my hands. I went looking. It took me a couple weeks, but I found Bill T. And Bill T was a grand sponsee of Don Pritz, and I had no idea what I was in for. And Bill T was a parole officer, hardcore man. There was no messing around with Bill. Bill saved my life. I meet with Bill the first time, and he said, "Pat, what do you know about the big book?" And he took me to the first page, and, you know, my book's a little... By the way, you have to always keep getting new big books because, you know, the scotch tape wears out, and you got pink on yellow and yellow on blue, and then the green's going on, and everything looks important on every page. Because guess what? Everything's important on every page, right? And so he takes me to the page where it's supposed to be empty. Let's see here. It'd be this page. Okay. And there's nothing on it. And I go, "What do you see?" And I go, "It's blank." He goes, "What you know about Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason you're dying is because you don't know what's wrong with you. The reason you're dying is you're not in the solution. You have no idea what we've done to get where we are. Are you willing to go forward?" And I said, "Anything you want, any day you want, all the time you want." And I lived with Bill T. I mean, I lived with that guy. God bless him, because he went through hell with me because I was messed up. I was so messed up in my head. And he started taking me through. And, you know, the first step, and he said to me, he said, "Pat, this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's more powerful than your physical body. It's more powerful than your mental, your mind. And it's more powerful than your spirit. Your spirit is sickened. You have a spiritual sickness. You have a spiritual malady. Your mind takes you to a place where you think that you are sane in your thinking and you are certifiably insane. And the scary thing about that statement is we think we're sane. Because I'm going to make my own decisions. I'm going to do life my own way. I'm going to do AA Pat's way. It's going to work. I'm going to 3 meetings a day. That'll work for anybody, don't you think? Meeting makers make it. Stay in the center of the herd. I knew everybody by first name. And I'm dying. If they could have a picture, I'm the one sheep in the group that's losing weight, and I'm skin and bones, and now my legs are failing, and I'm on the ground. That's who I am. And so he takes me through the first step, and he says to me, took me to the title page, and you know, we went through, I'm not going to go through all, I mean, I'm going to go through the steps tonight with you guys, but not everything, obviously, but he takes me to the title page, and he says, "I want you to see something," and he took his book, and he said, "The primary instructions of this program," and I said, there's more, Pat, it's 164 pages, but the primary instructions is 103 pages. You with me on that? Okay? And he said, "Here's 103 pages." He said, "I want you to open up to page 44. I get up to page 44, and he said, "I want you to hold it up. So you got two sides. This side, one to 40, or title page to 44. This side, 44 to 103. Pat, what do you observe about those pages?" I said, "Well, they look about the same, maybe a little bit more on this side." And he said, "Yeah. Guess what this is? Step one." Half of the pages in the first 103 are about step one. There's actually 43 pages plus 3 pages in We Agnostics plus 8 pages in Doctor's Opinion. They're dealing with one thing. Pat, you don't know what's wrong with you. Let's find out your truth. Do you identify with what we are going through as alcoholics? And if you identify at a core level, right? Maddox, you know this. If you identify with this at a core level, then steps 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 are going to be, you're going to clamor to get to steps 2 through 12. You're not going to be delaying. You're going to be clamoring to get there. You're not going to be doing any of this delay stuff. You're not going to be waiting on your four-step. You're not going to be, and I'm not against people waiting. I got one guy right now. I've got this four-step kind of, you know, he has an enema coming his way is what's going to go on. But love Johnny. Now he's on tape. Ah! But the bottom line is we're going to want this. You know why? Because we are going to know that this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's going to kill me. See, we have this myth around the room sometimes because we're all smiling and happy, but Bill says it well. Hey, even though it's happy-go-lucky on the outside, don't make any mistake because underneath it, we have deadly earnest. We're deadly serious. We got a life and death mission here. People die. And if you don't get this thing and you're the real deal, you're going to die. Or swear to goodness, you're going to wish you were dead. I meet a lot of people that come and start doing the work with us that have been sober 10, 12, 15, 20 years, and they're dying. They know they can't drink. They know that's not the answer. And they got that, but they don't know what the solution is. They're dying. They're crispy critters. They're brittle. And their lives are coming unglued. And I get it. The pride's so steeped. Hey, I know all this knowledge. I'm so well known in the groups and everything else, but I'm dying. And they'll make the call to you at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and they'll say, hey, can you meet? Absolutely. So we get through this, and he said to me, he said, Pat, the truth of step one is you absolutely will drink. Not that you can't drink. The truth of step one is that Pat T will drink again. On my own ability, on my own efforts, on my own guards, on my own trigger awareness, and whatever else that stuff means, I will absolutely drink. And unless I find a God experience that I could actually form a companionship with, in relationship with, I'm going to die. Now, when I came in here, I had sworn off God. Okay? I didn't tell you that part of the story. Now we're going to do the God stuff. And so people get all wigged out about God. Dr. Silkworth said at the very end of his letter, he said, listen, I hope you remain here to pray. Quit scoffing. Stay here to pray. Page 29 says, the whole purpose of telling you our stories, Pat, is so you could understand how we formed a relationship with who? God. Page 59 tells me there's only one that is more powerful than our powerful disease that we're up against, that's cunning, baffling, and powerful, that does not ever take a break, that never rests, that is always looking for new ways to attack me. And by the way, the drink doesn't come at us as a drink. It comes at us at a relationship gone south. It comes at us with credit card bills too much and overwhelming financial jeopardy. It comes at us with a fight with the spouse, a problem with the kid. It doesn't come as a drink. You get me on that? Cunning, baffling, and powerful. It raises the hair on my arms every time I think about that. There's only one that has all power, and that one is who? God. Okay? God. And I don't say it like you have to believe what I believe about God, but Ebby was very clear to Bill. Bill, I've had an experience with the Oxford group, and their God experience is through Christ. You ever wonder why on page 11 Bill's talking about Christ in the big book? He's talking about Christ in the big book because Ebby's telling him about his God experience through Christ. You don't have to agree with me on it, and it's okay if you don't. I didn't agree when I first heard that from my sponsor, Bill T. I didn't want to hear about that because I'd been praying to that guy and nothing was happening for 13 years. And, you know, you asked me about God, I wanted to be like Reagan in The Exorcist and spit green soup at you. I wasn't neutral about God. I wasn't just a little bit soured towards God. I was out and out at war with God. And what I didn't understand is I was at war with myself. Bill pointed out to me, he said, do you understand that when you came in these rooms, this is like two months into working with him and things are changing, the idea about suicide starting to pass, and the homicide towards you had not passed yet because I haven't done four step. True story. But this whole thing about God, he said, Pat, you knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You didn't know anything about your disease. You didn't know anything about the allergy. You didn't know anything about the obsession. You didn't know anything about the spiritual malady. How many months sober are you now? Like about five. And you're just now understanding your first step experience. How did you stay sober for month one, two, three, and four? Oh, yeah, fellowship and all the rest, that was helpful, no doubt about it. But it was the very hand of God that reached into the cave that I lived in the darkness that I lived in that pulled me out before I even wanted God and said, you're mine. You're mine. You're mine. None of you are not his. We're his kids. He says, I love you too much to leave you in that hell. You're mine. Come home. It's like the prodigal son in the Bible, but the prodigal son story is pretty dang cool. Guy uses up all dad's money before he should have gotten dad's inheritance, goes off to the far country, spends it all in loose living. He's in Vegas doing the thing. And he blows it all and he has no money left. And he says, God dang it, I can't live anymore. I'm slopping hogs and trying to get corn cobs for food. If I go back to daddy, you can't call him daddy anymore. I won't even call him father because I've lost that right. But man, he's a rich man. Maybe I could work for him. See, he doesn't know his dad. Because he had stolen basically half of the inheritance. And he had disrespected his dad by asking for it publicly with attitude in front of others in the community. And his dad gave him half of the inheritance. He didn't have to, and he did it. He goes off the far country, and he blows it all. And he's at the end of his rope. And so he says, you know what? I can't keep on living this way. At least I could be hired in on dad's farm, dad's property, and I could just do his work. And so he starts making his way home, and he's trying to remember. He's trying to recite what he's going to say to his former father, now future employer. And he's coming over the hill and he's looking down into the valley where dad's place is. And he looks down and his eyes are even blown. But he could see this character running towards him. And this character's an older man and he's a little stumbly in his walk, but he's running towards him. He gets closer and closer and closer. And you know what I'm going to tell you? Who is it? It's his father. His father is running, which, by the way, in culture was not ever supposed to be done. His father was running against what culture said he should be doing. And he's running to this kid who had taken everything, had disrespected him, had thrown his life away, and had given him the finger. And he's running to this man. And he gets to him. And the kid starts to say, Father, I... And the father just... Stop talking. Stop talking. I love you. You were dead and you've come home and now you're alive. He picks out of his pocket and he puts a ring on his finger, which back in the day was identification. I belong to my papa's house. Oh, man. He puts a robe around this guy's back. You've got the protection of your Father. Everybody will see this purple robe and they will know from afar. They can't see your ring, but they see the robe. You belong to me. Come home. We're going to have a party like you've never seen. We're going to have a celebration. And see, that's what's going to happen with us. We go through these steps and we have a celebration coming our way. And I go, but God, I don't know you. I don't trust you. I prayed to you and I didn't understand. Pat, you were praying for the wrong thing. You wanted me to take away just your alcoholism. It was a settlement. I wanted to give you a new life. You wanted to be free from the drink, and I wanted to give you a new life. See, we'll settle. Without God, we settle. We don't desire the gifts and the beauty and the blessings God wants to give to us. But through these steps, because of the courage of a step three experience, where we finally come home to our Father, a prodigal experience, Bill Wilson went from an impersonal God, Spirit of the universe, Czar of the heavens, infinite intelligence, beyond limitation, beyond time and limitation, right? You remember that? And 2 pages later, he's calling his newfound friend, who he's going to commit his life to, give his life to. Why? Because he has no other choice. We're going to talk about that bargain here in just a minute. Gives his life to, and then says to his newfound friend, all the stuff that's got me jammed up, all the stuff that's blowing up my life, all the stuff that's rebellion against you. You know what fear is? You know what fear is? It's rebellion against your God. It's rebellion against my God. That's what my fear is. I'm saying God is not enough. That's literally what I'm saying. I always ask the question when I was doing my 11th. By the way, I practice these steps. I'm a dog. I do this deal. In an 11-step review, I was asking God one. I said, God, why am I always asking for forgiveness? Well, Pat, you keep trying to play God. You keep trying to play God, and you're not very good at it. You keep jamming it up. But this fear thing that we go into is because we are in rebellion. I'm in rebellion. I don't want God. I don't want God to run my life. I want God to make me comfortable, but I don't want to be changed. You get me on that? Oh, I'll pursue ease and comfort. Oh, I want to be satisfied. Oh, I don't want to be restless anymore. Oh, I want to be content. But that's not what the big book talks about. The big book says if you truly get this thing of freedom in your step four experience in terms of getting to the truth about your inventory, getting to the truth about how you're trying to arrange the lights and how you are literally, without intentionality, harming everyone you come in contact and making chaos and confusion at everything you touch. Pat, that's what you do. And the fear's driving the whole train, and you can't stop it from going. It's like a fear generation machine inside of me. Here's another little fear. Hi, fear. How are you? You know, and it just comes popping up, and it shows up in my relationships, and I can't make the relationships work. Man, I would care for her if she'd just care for me. If I could just get my needs met first, then I'd care for you. No, I'm not going to tell you the truth. I'm too scared of you. Because if you knew who I am, you wouldn't want to be around me. Principal inventory out of the 4th step taught me that one. And we start getting free in the truth about our 4th step, and we start having an experience with somebody that's loving and caring and honest, like I've been hearing about Don P. and a lot of you guys this weekend. Man, what a blessing you guys are to me. We start to get free. And we have a 5th step experience. We start to be able to look the world in the eye. And we get to a step 6, and I go, I am done. And the bargain with God is this. Pat, I know you don't know much about me. Just give me everything there is about you to everything you know about me, and it'll be enough. Sam Shoemaker told that to Bill Wilson. Bill, quit making it more difficult. Everything you know about yourself, just give to everything you know about God. it'll be enough. Cornerstone decision, it'll be enough to start the deal. You rock and roll. And you know what? When I came in here, I didn't have a belief in the God that I believe in today. But I believe strongly, and I've seen it for 21 and a half years of sponsoring people and like a mad dog. I sponsor like all you guys. I mean, I'm not anything unusual in this group. We see it all the time. We watch people's lives change all the time. We see the miracle of change happen all the time when they do this work. That's what gives me faith. I watch God do God miracles in your life. I go to God and I go, God, there is no way you're going to get this guy. This guy is a train wreck. Thank you. Train wreck. Not even allowed to be in the same universe, God. I have no idea what you're going to do with this guy. And here's the deal. I try to encapsulate it so I can. I'm simple. I'm simple-minded in a lot of ways. You know, I don't have an original thought. God makes a bargain, makes a deal with me that I can't even believe happened in this universe. And when I grab hold of it, it's hard for me to talk. Pat, tell me about yourself. I'm a serial cheater. A lie in work. I cheat in work. And by the way, I made all my amends. All means all. I cheat in work. I lie to my fellows. I let down my kids. I abuse my kids. I abuse my first wife, my second wife. God, I had good intention, but I could never finish anything. I had great moral convictions. I had philosophical convictions. I had moral code. I couldn't live up to any of it. I want to commit suicide. And I want to kill everybody else. Anything else I ought to know about you? Yeah, I'm not sure if I really believe in you either. Because I prayed to you for 13 years. Really, when I got serious about praying to you for 13 years, you never did anything. I was a little bit like Fitzmaio at the end of More About Alcoholism, the story. You know? He had given up on God. He really had. And then God did a God thing in his life. See, God meets us when we're at the end of our rope. See, God does God stuff. And he shows off. God shows off. He changes our hearts when our hearts are stone cold, killing sore, and shot. Puts them in the flesh, puts them in the real, puts them in the big. Our life changes. So, Pat, that's about the size of it? That's who you are? I go, yeah, that's about the size of it. Well, let me tell you who I am. This is out of the big book, by the way. I'm not preaching. Right here. I'm an all-knowing, I'm an all-powerful, I'm an all-loving God. I've come to rescue you. I will protect you. You could count on me. And when you say your third step prayer and you go into your inventory and you go into your fifth step and you go into your sixth step and you go into your seventh step, I'm there. I was there before you got to the first step, and I was there when you were trying to figure out if you were powerless. I was there. And when you get through and you're going to 8 and 9, I will be there when you're knocking on that first door and your heart's in your throat. I will show you forgiveness, and I will show you how to give forgiveness. My power in your life, because page 25 says it's a miracle that we're all here. Central fact, great fact. Great fact today is that God has done something miraculous in our lives, right? He has changed the way I conceive of life itself, my heart, my thoughts, my being. Central fact, he's done miracles in me. Page 20, I read that and I'll be almost done. Great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have a deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized. Do you need a revolution in your thinking and feeling? Me too. But today even, always seek. There's more. Infinite supply. Revolutionize our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, towards God's universe. Does it get any bigger? That covers quite a bit. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator, the one that made you, you are a masterpiece. You are not a mistake. You are not a mistake. The accuser, leave him alone. Don't listen to that stuff. You're not a mistake. You're a masterpiece, and God's unfolding you. certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts, changed our hearts and our lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. That's not difficult, that's impossible. God makes a pathway through the impossible. God makes possible what's impossible. I'll close with this. The spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening that God promises all of us is always evolving. Step 10 tells me I could grow my understanding and effectiveness with God relationship. I do some things to be watchful. I have some daily disciplines. I learn some prayer and meditation. I learn some way of being of service. I learn that the way to have freedom and joy and peace in my heart is to give away my life for the rest of my days. I'm 65 years old and I'm praying to God to give me a couple till 20. I'm hoping I get 20 more. When you look at my body, you look at what I've done, if I get 20, that's a miracle of God. But here's the point. Every day, God, please use me. Share this message. Take this message. Because the gift that each one of us have in this message that we get to carry is second to nothing in this universe. I love you. I mean that. Thank you for letting me share.